Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
As we look at the winter wheat conditions and concerns for that pretty much mature crop in the south sitting in wet fields, at this point we're not seeing a real national effect on that. Pretty steady on the wheat condition, 54% good to excellent, 16% very poor to poor, only small changes from last week as you would expect this time of year.
That's Brad Rippey, meteorologist with USDA on winter wheat conditions.
As the season winds down, we see roughly a fifth of the crop, 22%, rated very poor to poor in Montana, where it's still not fully mature. As you move further south, pretty well locked in, 19% very poor to poor in top producer Kansas. And we see similar numbers as you move into Texas, where the crop is basically mature, just waiting to be harvested. 25% of the crop in Texas rated very poor to poor.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Thank you, Mr. President, for inviting us here to the White House to provide an update on our coordinated efforts across your federal government to ensure our nation's wildland firefighting system is focused on fighting wildfires quickly and effectively.
Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins at the White House on Tuesday addressing reporters about the wildfire season.
You have made it clear from the beginning that strong leadership and decisive action and the protection of American lives and communities are the top priorities for both Secretary Burgum and for me this fire season. As you can see from the red areas on the map over here on the president's left, this is going to be an above normal fire season, which is why we wanted to, sir, ensure that we were taking direction from you and moving forward. This means that a higher likelihood of large and intense wildfires than typically expected for this time of year for the next few months. This means that people, homes, communities, and landscapes are at risk, and the need for firefighters and fire support personnel is clear. America has the largest and the most well-respected wildland firefighting force in the world. Secretary Burgum and I already have given direction to our firefighting organizations to take whatever actions are necessary to ensure that we are operationally ready. The Department of Interior and the Department of Agriculture employ over 17,000 federal wildland firefighters every year. At the peak of fire capacity, our surge with their interagency, tribal, state, local, will have approximately 13,000 additional wildfire personnel. We know that the best and most cost-effective way to stop these terrible fires is to remove the fuel load that feeds them. And we can talk a little bit about the timber executive order, the timber leadership the president has led on. We are working at both of our agencies to eliminate all red tape, cut costs, and increase our timber sales and active management to reduce the intensity of these wildfires when they start. We are increasing timber production by 25%, thanks to President Trump, with the goal of not only supporting our industry partners and our rural communities, but also reducing the number of catastrophic wildfires. Finally, both the Forest Service, reducing hazardous fuels on our 4.2 million acres, and the Department of Interior on their 2.4 million acres annually, getting rid of the low-value overgrown trees and brush crowding of our forests. One final point, we are 96% capacity in terms of our firefighting hiring, and this is actually ahead of where President Biden and his team was a year ago. So I want to make sure that's very clear. We are all on board and moving forward with a fully operational. We will be more ready than ever before for this season.
Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins at the White House. U.S. and Chinese officials wrapped up trade talks in London, agreeing on a framework to ease export restrictions and stabilize their trade truce. The deal, held at Lancaster House, includes lifting China's restrictions on rare earth minerals and magnets, and that was confirmed by U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Notably, the agreement also addresses ag. Bloomberg says China's committing to increase purchases of U.S. ag products, including soybeans and pork, to support American farmers. And a Chinese vice commerce minister said the framework builds on a May 2025 Geneva tariff reduction deal and will be presented to leaders of both countries for approval. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
For more than 40 years, we've helped ag organizations find and develop talent, and right now, that leadership pipeline is under serious strain.
Testifying before a Senate Committee on Aging, Aaron Locker, Managing Director of Kincannon and Reed.
In 2025, more people will turn 65 than in any year in history. For every potential leader aged 35 to 50, two are preparing to retire. In agriculture, where many senior leaders have been in place for decades, this creates an acute succession challenge. And the next generation of leaders, especially those with agricultural backgrounds, is smaller than ever. This is not a coincidence. The 1980s farm crisis didn't just hurt balance sheets. It changed the interest in being involved in agriculture. The farm crisis didn't just hurt those in production, but the ripple effect was across the industry. Between 1980 and 1990, while college enrollment went up 7% nationwide, enrollment in land-grant university colleges of agriculture like Texas A&M, Nebraska, Minnesota, Penn State, and Iowa State, to name a few, dropped by nearly 37%. That gap is being realized today in boardrooms, field offices, and agronomy teams. Meanwhile, the complexity of agriculture is growing. Precision and decision ag technologies, automation, AI on the farm, and sustainability initiatives, they're moving fast. But fewer than one-third of ag companies that we work with have formal succession plans. That's not just a statistic, that's a systemic risk. Job growth in agriculture is steady, around 3% per year. But tech and finance are growing three times faster. So we're not just competing for talent, we are competing for leadership. And that matters. Because, as you mentioned, Chairman Scott, food security is national security. Attracting and retaining the next generation also depends on profitability and predictability. When farmers and agribusinesses face constant regulatory uncertainty or rising compliance costs, it discourages investment and makes leadership succession harder. To keep agriculture strong, we must reduce unnecessary regulatory burdens and ensure producers and those across the industry see a future worth building toward. This is not a challenge the private agribusiness sector can solve alone. Congress does have a vital role to play, and I respectfully offer four recommendations. First, pass a strong, fully funded farm bill. It provides stability for farmers, ranchers, and rural communities. Second, promote agriculture as a mission-driven, modern career path. No other sector blends health, nutrition, energy, and technology like agriculture. We have built the safest, most abundant food supply in the world, but that system will not sustain itself without the people who lead it. Young people and career changers need to see ag as a place to lead and innovate. Third, invest in leadership development. Support USDA scholarships, executive fellowships, and training through land-grant universities and ag nonprofits. And fourth, strengthen rural workforce development. That means apprenticeships, veteran transitions, and community college ag programs. And it means building career paths from urban and suburban areas into agriculture. In closing, the food and agriculture industries are evolving fast, but our leadership pipeline is not keeping up. This is not just a workforce issue. It's a threat to our most essential system, our food supply. If we want a strong, sustainable agricultural future, we must invest in people. We must identify and support leaders early, and we must give them room to grow.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Risk tolerance is really important to kind of gauge and understand what level of risk people have.
In a recent video podcast, University of Nebraska Lincoln's Ag Economics Extension educator, Shannon Sand, breaking down risk tolerance when it comes to insurance for livestock producers.
One way to do that, that we have talked about, is break-even calculations. We have a few different resources that you can use for that. So we have the, it's free at UNL, it's the break-even calculator that Dr. Matt Stockton came up with, and I've worked on some. And then the free UNL Ag Budget Calculator for enterprise budgeting, which is really great, especially if you're looking at different cropping options, different scenarios, doing some cash flow work. Again, both of these are free options for you to use and are available. So feel free to check them out. I've worked on development on both sides of these. So if you have questions, again, feel free to contact myself or Dr. Matt Stockton. But really, how much coverage do you need is based on how much risk tolerance you have. And some of that, again, is, do I have other assets to cover bills? Is there a way that if something, God forbid, happens and we have some sort of crazy market event, that that I can cover all of my needs, that I can, as I like to say, that I can keep the lights on, you know? So I like to read, so electricity is important at night. So again, one way to do that is break even. And like I said, we have a couple of different free resources. There's actually more than this at UNL, but that's what's available. So you can also calculate break even yourself. It's pretty easy. I pulled this from Dr. Larry Van Tassel's article that he did a few years back. And basically, it's calculating your break-even price. You just take your total cost divided by whatever your expected yield is, and that gives you an idea of what you need to break even. So, and you can further break that down by per animal, per pound, per hunter weight, whatever you need. So it depends on what you're doing, right? What you need to do.
Of course, some of the questions are how much, why, and when should I do this?
Depending on your risk tolerance, if you have money in the bank, if you have assets available that you can liquidate if an emergency happens. And again, this is a big if, but the reality is, you know, we got hail here the other week, right? So I was like, it happens. Things happen. So making sure, again, what your financial analysis is going to be real important. And that helps you decide how much coverage you need, or is one way that can help you decide how much coverage do you need. This is an example using break even. So once you have your break even, basically what you're going to do is you're going to look at coverage level options and compare to your break even. Dr. Larry Van Tassel, Dr. Jay Parsons, they've all done work in this area. So we have a lot of articles on that will be listed at the end of this presentation as well. So if you want further resources, that's available. But basically, once you look at that, you compare it to coverage level options and look at, in this case, let's say LRP using the RMAs, that you can go to rma.usda.gov, and they have a website devoted entirely to, if we're looking at livestock risk protection, different coverage levels, the cost per hunter weight of that. And then again, you can make your decision based off of your break even and how many pounds/animals you need covered.
And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're going to be doing some great work having to do with forest fires. It's going to start effective. Really, it started a few months ago, and it's forest management.
From the Oval Office on Tuesday, President Trump, along with Interior Secretary Doug Burgum.
Doug, I think you're really the head of that. Interior is, I guess, you're the largest landlord, perhaps anywhere in the world. I understand that's a nice position. You may want to just give a few words on the cleaning of the floor of the forests.
Well, I'm happy to do that. And, of course, as President Trump had said, yes, between Interior and Forest Service, which is part of USDA, 700 million acres of surface area, much of that is in forest land. That is a tremendous resource. It's part of America's balance sheet. When we let it burn, then we actually have to spend money coming through FEMA and other places. So we spend taxpayer dollars cleaning up a mess that could have been prevented. Under President Trump, when we get back into the timber business, which up to 30 years ago, we were one of the great timber producers in the world. Communities thrived in these rural communities. We had lumber mills. We had manufacturing. We had furniture makers in this country. All of that went away when we stopped harvesting our own timber. And today, we import about as much timber as we used to harvest ourselves. If we can get back in the timber business, that can help on the balance of trade, reduce imports from foreign countries, and have American jobs. But to make that all happen, again, under President Trump's leadership, we have to get back in the timber business and get back in the game. And when we do that, we have to make sure that we're doing prevention, not just fighting fires after they all get out of control. And so, again, working with OMB and others to make sure that we've got the budget for doing the prevention work and the forest management up front reduces the expense and the cost on the back end of fighting these massive fires. But, again, coordinating across all of our five different major firefighting groups today, it's like having five generals in the field. They may have different strategies and different tactics. They even have different pay levels. Brooke and I are working to make sure that regardless of which service and branch that you're in, that you're going to have similar pay, that we're going to have everybody equipped with the right technology to protect them when they're out in the field. Just basic stuff that they don't have today that we were giving our military 20 years ago in terms of and then using technology to be able to identify fires when they first start. I mean, with infrared, satellite, drones, I mean, there's technology where we can pick out a fire when it just barely begins and it costs us nothing to put it out versus when it scales up and becomes these massive fires that endanger communities, lives, and our firefighters. So President Trump, of course, has got a common sense strategy. He's empowering all of the leadership that's standing up here today for us to go get this job done. It's going to get America back in the timber business. We're going to put out fires when they're small and as opposed to when we can't control them when they're large. And we're going to have revenue coming into the federal government from those timber sales as opposed to those timber leases to the private companies as opposed to revenue going out through FEMA after the fact when we're cleaning up a mess. So the whole thing makes complete sense. Brooke and I and Christy and Russ, we're all excited to go out and implement the president's vision.
And we have some of the best timber anywhere in the world. We don't use it. We've freed it up. Lee Zeldin's done an incredible job in that regard from environmental restrictions that are ridiculous. And a lot of it's been freed up. The rest of it's being freed up. Some areas will continue to protect, but we're going to be freeing up most of it. And again, we have some of the best in the world. And when I hear you say that we lost more at fires than we produce, it's so crazy because we shouldn't lose very much at all. I could say we shouldn't lose any if it was perfect, but it should not be ever like what we've seen. We're sending billions of dollars to California all the time because obviously in California they are not doing a good job in any way, shape, or form.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The MAHA, the Make America Healthy Again report that was issued, that thing's 69 pages in length, and what it does is lay out a roadmap that Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. thinks federal agencies can use to reduce chronic childhood illnesses in this country.
Washburn University tax law specialist Roger McCowan.
At the top of the list, as you could probably anticipate, is poor diet. I think some of the key stats coming out of the report is that 70% of food that most children consume contains ultra-processed ingredients. Now, there's a tie-in to Farm Bill programs there and SNAP programs because unless they reform SNAP, then what we're having is the government subsidizing low-quality food that children are able to eat through the SNAP program, then which exacerbates the poor diet program, then we end up paying more money on the healthcare side of things on the back end. So they can address that and reform SNAP at the same time. That'd be a good deal. And there's some other big stats in this that are just glaring, too. One of them is a 1,400% increase in antidepressant prescriptions among young people over the past 20 years and a 250% increase in ADHD prescriptions between 2006 and 2016. And one stat that showed that there are three times as many children that are obese today as compared to the 1970s. Now, that's on a percentage basis. And then that 75% of eligible young people can't qualify for the military largely because of obesity and that more than 40% of children in the U.S. have at least one chronic health condition, and that percentage has gone way up since the 1970s. And a lot of those are probably linked together. Obesity can lead to sedentary behavior, which then can lead to depression, which then can lead to being medicated. So it can be, and it is for some, a pretty vicious cycle.
What has the reaction from ag been?
There are some that have been saying, well, it's about time we told you so, and there's one segment of agriculture that is saying that. The other segment is saying, well, you know, this is the most efficient food production system. Everybody likes cheap food, and I get that. But the question then is cheap food really cheap if it's increasing the health cost for people? And that's difficult to measure, but that really does bring some questions forward. And I think that the nice thing about the report is it's focusing on wellness rather than just treating symptoms. It's trying to get at the causes to the symptoms and reform the way that we look at things in this country. And that's a good thing. Maybe we'll get some people thinking about these things more in depth, and some things will change. And we've seen some of that already with some of the dyes being removed from food and a push to get other things out of food that, for example, are not in food in Europe and places in the Mediterranean that they don't allow in other parts of the world, but we do here. And correlation and causation are not necessarily always the same thing, but there may be quite a bit of that actually in our food distribution system here. So it'll be interesting to see how this actually plays out in the regulatory and administrative system.
Now, there's another hot issue that's working its way through the courts.
Constitutional issues were raised in a Swampbuster case coming out of Iowa. And while the court said that the farmer really couldn't challenge the regs because he hadn't exhausted his administrative remedies through the USDA administrative appeal process, they went ahead and upheld the Swampbuster regs by saying that it's not the Commerce Clause that applies, but they're valid under the spending authority of the Congress, which can tie all types of conditions to the receipt of funds, such as federal farm programs. So that'll be an interesting case to see what happens as it winds its way through the process.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There are a number of explanations for the increased U.S. farm age. One is that there's a larger share of commercial farms that are multi-generational in nature.
At a recent Senate Committee on Aging hearing, Dr. Chris Wolf, ag economist and professor at Cornell University.
Rather than the kids operating separate farms like they would have done maybe when I was kind of thinking about going back to the farm, they return to the operation and become owners, which enables economies of size and production and management. In this case, the management team might have a younger average age that is masked by considering only the primary operator. Modern agricultural production also tends to be quite capital intensive, and that capital accumulation occurs over the manager's lifetime, the result being that the average farm age is getting older. Finally, given the USDA definition of a farm as any place with $1,000 or more of agricultural products produced and sold or normally produced and sold during a year, there are a large percentage of farms which are operated as part-time businesses, and there's nothing wrong with that. But this also means that if someone retires to some rural acreage, they will be included as a farm and increased farm age. This is not meant to imply that there are no issues with farm viability related to increasing farmer age. These include hurdles that limit the entry of young people into farming and the need to facilitate the transfer of assets to the next generation while providing the resources necessary for the retirement of the older generation. Family-owned farms, which are 96% of U.S. farms, are closely held businesses. The farms tend to be of the size that meets the management constraints and the income needs of the family owner-operators. Because of the capital requirements, farm business assets are often the retirement plan for farmers. While these farmers hope to pass the business to the next generation, they also need to recover the equity value to fund their retirement. Attracting the next generation of farm business owner-managers means making the profession attractive in terms of income and rural amenities. Significant impediments to successful intergenerational transfer often relate to information gaps, and this is where land-grant extension programs can be a valuable partner. New York FarmNet is a program that was created in 1986 in response to the farm financial crisis. The program operates a toll-free number that responds to requests with a team of financial and mental health professionals to meet with farm families at no cost. Including mental health professionals was motivated by the alarming fact that farmers face much higher rates of depression and suicide than the general population. FarmNet receives about 700 calls a year, resulting in about 400 new cases being opened. The remaining calls are referred for technical, accounting, or legal assistance. Sources of financial stress that FarmNet sees include price uncertainty, labor costs and availability, capital costs, land access, and estate and succession planning. Family-related stressors include health issues, child care, elder care, and drug and alcohol abuse. Agriculture ranks among the most dangerous industries in the U.S., with machinery accidents and injuries being common. Healthcare issues include not just the cost, but also the availability and proximity. Farmers often report delaying or avoiding healthcare due to cost, distance, and time constraints. Many farmers are underinsured or uninsured, especially those who are self-employed and operate small family farms. Farm business succession is a major source of financial and family-related stress on farms. FarmNet and Cornell Cooperative Extension and land grants across the country offer educational workshops and materials on farm business succession and estate transfer. In 2024, farm net assisted farm businesses that represented over $13 million in revenue, 600 employees, keeping more than 180,000 acres active in farming. FarmNet's experience is that managers who participate in these programs for estate planning and farm business transfer are likely to engage with attorneys and accountants to complete successful intergenerational transfer. Applied research and extension land grant programs like FarmNet can provide valuable assistance to help ensure successful farm business transitions in a healthy U.S. agricultural sector.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As parts of the country in recent weeks have experienced off-and-on extreme heat events, for cattle producers, preparing now for what may be a long summer for livestock will protect herds from potential heat stress and related issues.
The plan here is to be ready with shades, to be ready with sprinklers, to be ready with bedding.
Alfredo DiCostanzo of University of Nebraska Extension says when it comes to managing heat stress in cattle,
it's a very comprehensive approach, which in many cases we need to start thinking about this very early on in the time period.
Or when a locale or region has a break between extreme heat events. The comprehensive management approach not only includes methods to keep cattle cool.
Light control. Flies, especially the barn fly, loads on these cattle and bites their legs, bites their faces. And so we want those flies to leave them alone so they're not stomping, adding to activity and heating those cattle up.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.